This is a special report on the life of Gerald R. Ford, the 38th President of the United States. I'm Linda Wertheimer in Washington. Gerald Ford came to the White House by a road not taken by any leader before or since. He was appointed vice president, the first such appointment under a new constitutional amendment, and then he took over the presidency when, in another first in our national history, a president stepped down. It was a harrowing time in this country as a presidency fell apart before our eyes, and the possibility that a president of the United States might be impeached and thrown out of office seemed likely. And even though Gerald Ford had not been elected, had never run for national office, and was not even very well known, he clearly understood the sense of relief with which the American people greeted their new president on August 9, 1974.
My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over. Our Constitution works. Our great republic is a government of laws and not of men. Here, the people rule. But there is a higher power. By whatever name, we honor him, who ordains not only righteousness but love, not only justice but mercy. As we bind up the internal wounds of Watergate, more painful and more poisonous than those of foreign wars, let us restore the golden rule to our political process, and let brotherly love purge our hearts of suspicion and of hate.
The long national nightmare, Watergate, started with the so-called third-rate burglary of the National Democratic Party headquarters in June of 1972 at the now-famous office building on the banks of the Potomac River. The burglary and the reasons for it faded away over the next 2 years as a series of investigations revealed that President Nixon had been personally involved, perhaps not in planning the break-in, but in orchestrating the cover-up. In the end, the president himself was forced by the Supreme Court to deliver the evidence against him. Tapes recorded in the Oval Office included a conversation between the president and his chief aide, H.R. Haldeman, on how to block the FBI investigation of Watergate. That was the long-sought smoking gun. And when it was made public, the House Judiciary Committee quickly voted articles of impeachment and sent them on to the full House. That precipitated the president's decision 3 days later to appear before the American people on August 8th with this dramatic statement.
America needs a full-time president and a full-time Congress, particularly at this time with problems we face at home and abroad, to continue to fight through the months ahead for my personal vindication would almost totally absorb the time and attention of both the president and the Congress in a period when our entire focus should be on the great issues of peace abroad and prosperity without inflation at home. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office.
It was a great source of pride for President Ford that what happened the next day was orderly and calm. Gerald Ford and his wife Betty walked with President Nixon and his wife Pat to a helicopter on the White House grounds and said goodbye. And then at noon, Mr. Ford entered the East Room of the White House to be sworn in by Chief Justice Warren Burger as the 38th President of the United States.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do solemnly swear.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute
the office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability.
And will, to the best of my ability,
preserve, protect, and defend.
Preserve, protect, and defend
the Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
Speaking to the crowd assembled in the East Room, mostly members of the Nixon cabinet and staff, Mr. Ford indicated that his inaugural address would not be a grand and formal speech, but instead a little straight talk among friends. He promised a presidency of truth, openness, and candor.
The oath that I have taken is the same oath that was taken by George Washington and by every president under the Constitution. But I assume the presidency under extraordinary circumstances never before experienced by Americans. This is an hour of history that troubles our minds and hurts our hearts.
One of the people in the East Room that day was young Roger Porter. He's now a professor of government and business at Harvard University. But in the summer of 1974, as a young graduate student, he had successfully competed for a White House fellowship and had asked to be assigned to the vice president's staff. He never made it to the vice president's actual office. The day he arrived, his new boss stepped up to the presidency, and Roger Porter was whisked off to the White House for the swearing-in.
It was a very sobering day and ceremony, in large part because it was a president coming into office not on the wave of an electoral victory and all the anticipation that is associated with events like that. It was really summarized in a line in his speech where he spoke the words, "Our long national nightmare is over." And as he spoke those words, you could sense in the audience the realization that, in fact, this was beginning a new chapter and a fresh chapter and putting a close to a previous chapter that had seemed to drag on for many, many months, and one in which people sort of felt an air of inevitability once President Nixon's support, both in the country and in the Congress, headed south and never to return. I think most people recognized the fact that there was a need for a change, and that Gerald Ford was, in fact, a wonderful choice for that change.
Gerald Ford was just 61 when he became president. Tall, fit, and broad-shouldered, handsome in a bluff Midwestern way, he seemed the polar opposite of the president he replaced. Roger Porter.
I remember about 3 days into office, his vice presidential staff, and since I had arrived and been on the vice presidential staff for 3.5 hours, I was included in this, were invited over to the residence up into the family quarters. Ford thought, well, it would be kind of nice to invite my vice presidential staff over and let them see the rooms where we live. And I remember talking with one of the ushers and a Secret Service agent there. I said, gee, is this typical? And they said, well, I've been here for 4 years, and President Nixon never had people come up in here.
Mr. Ford's straight-talking, down-to-earth approach to his new job helped the American people feel enormously relieved and not especially worried that the man at the helm had never been elected to anything other than one seat in the House of Representatives from Grand Rapids, Michigan. But he had spent his entire career in Congress, and while he knew that an inauguration at such a terrible time could never be the kind of celebration on the Capitol steps we now see every 4 years, he did want to take the oath in the chamber of the House where he'd served for so long.
The decision not to have it at the Capitol was disappointing for Ford. He really wanted to be inaugurated up on Capitol Hill.
John Robert Green is a professor of history and humanities at Cazenovia College in upstate New York.
But Watergate had hit such a fever pitch, and Nixon's resignation was still so fresh in people's mind that the people around Ford, and particularly the people who Ford had inherited from Nixon, most notably General Alexander Haig, who was at the time serving as his chief of staff, did not want to put him in a position where Congress would be so warm and fuzzy in their welcome of Ford that it would be the classic stab in the back to Nixon on his way out of town. And Ford was talked out of it, and against his wishes had the swearing in for the presidency at the White House.
In his book, The Presidency of Gerald Ford, Professor Green says that Mr. Ford sought in his inaugural talk to wash Watergate out of the minds of the American people. That would prove difficult, even disastrous, for President Ford. But on that summer day in the East Room of the White House, it seemed possible. At the end of his remarks, Mr. Ford brought up his predecessor, speaking with compassion and emotion in his voice.
Before closing, I ask again your prayers for Richard Nixon and for his family. May our former president, who brought peace to millions, find it for himself.
Just about a month later, President Ford made a critical decision, one which arguably doomed his presidency. He decided that the country could not leave Watergate behind if the former president were to remain in the news for weeks, months, perhaps even years, as the country considered the possibility he might be tried for crimes committed during his presidency, that he might even join numbers of his former staff in prison. President Ford decided to put Richard Nixon out of the reach of prosecution by using the unique power of presidential pardon. On September 8th, after very little consultation, another dramatic announcement.
I, Gerald R. Ford, President of the United States, pursuant to the pardon power conferred upon me by Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, have granted, and by these presents do grant, a full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon for all offenses against the United States which he, Richard Nixon, has committed or may have committed or taken part in during the period from July 20, 1969 through August 9, 1974.
On that evening, the new president's popularity fell from more than 70% to less than 50. Coming up, more about the pardon, how the decision was made and the overwhelmingly negative reaction that greeted it, plus more about the brief but important presidency of Gerald Ford. You're listening to a special report from NPR News. This is a special report from NPR News on the 38th President of the United States, Gerald R. Ford. I'm Linda Wertheimer in Washington. Gerald Ford grew up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, working in the family paint factory and playing football. He was a star in high school and then college, playing center for the University of Michigan. Both the Packers and the Lions were interested in him, but instead of turning pro, he went to law school at Yale and then straight back to Grand Rapids, a real all-around Midwestern boy. Harvard professor Roger Porter.
After getting out of the Navy and coming back and starting his law practice and almost immediately getting married and running for Congress, he then spent 25 years in Washington, the longest-serving member of Congress who has become president of the United States.
He was elected soon after the war, in 1948. In those days, transportation was difficult, and members of Congress moved their families to the Capitol while they served. Professor Porter, who worked in the Ford White House, says you might think that would make Gerald Ford a Washingtonian, but not so.
Gerald Ford managed, I think, as well as anyone, to balance learning, understanding, and becoming a part of the Washington community, and at the same time never losing touch of his roots in Grand Rapids and with the people of the 5th Congressional District in Michigan. And he was someone who was able to live very comfortably in both of those worlds.
Congress was a good fit for Mr. Ford from the beginning. He liked the collegial atmosphere of the House as it was then. He formed lasting friendships with many of the people with whom he served, one of them, young Congressman Richard Nixon. In 1961, Mr. Ford was named the Congressman's Congressman by the American Political Science Association, a tribute to his understanding of the workings of the House of Representatives. 2 years later, in a revolt of Young Turks, a group of progressive Republicans, which included Illinois Congressman Donald Rumsfeld, Mr. Ford captured the number 3 spot in the GOP leadership, upsetting a man 20 years his senior. In 1965, after the crushing Goldwater defeat, Congressman Ford went after the last of the old guard.
Quite frankly, it would have been far easier for me to have avoided this contest. But I am convinced that meaningful changes must be made now for the benefit of the Republican Party and for the preservation of our two-party system. For these reasons, on this occasion, I announce my candidacy for the House Republican Minority Leadership.
Mr. Ford won, and he was still Republican leader when, in 1973, Spiro Agnew resigned the office of vice president after pleading no contest to charges relating to a bribery scandal during his days as governor of Maryland. Under the 25th Amendment, which was only 6 years old, President Nixon was empowered to choose Agnew's successor, but Congress had to confirm the appointment. John Robert Green, Ford's biographer, says President Nixon chose Mr. Ford knowing that in the middle of Watergate, he was not in a position to choose just anyone.
And so Nixon put out a rather novel call to the leadership of both parties and asked them to fill out a questionnaire and asked them who they would choose. Were they in his shoes? And in every one of these questionnaires, Gerry Ford came up number one.
Beyond his personal popularity in Congress, Mr. Ford was the choice of Republicans and Democrats because Republicans felt he would be loyal to the embattled president and, if necessary, a suitable replacement, and Democrats believed that if he were to become president, he might be beatable in the next election. Members of both parties knew how high the stakes were when Mr. Ford testified before his colleagues in Congress as part of the confirmation process. Here again is John Robert Green.
Everybody knew that this was a dry run for Watergate. And everybody except Nixon seemed to know that they were nominating and confirming the next president. And so it was a very long process. The vetting process was, you take a look at the Supreme Court nominations that we've had in recent years, and Gerry Ford's vetting process was more expansive to the nth degree. This was an incredibly detailed process.
My impression of the confirmation process was that he really knocked it out of the park.
Oh, absolutely. When Gerry Ford sat down with his friends on Capitol Hill, it was old friends week. They liked this guy. He bantered. He smiled. He enjoyed that camaraderie. And I think that the conclusion that he knocked it out of the park is right on the money.
As expected, Mr. Ford had no difficulty being confirmed, although there were a few Democratic votes against him in the House and Senate. He had a vice presidential inauguration of sorts in the House chamber, where he was typically modest about his new role as vice president.
I'm a Ford, not a Lincoln. My addresses will never be as eloquent as Mr. Lincoln's. But I will do my very best to equal his brevity and his plain speaking. I'm deeply grateful to you, Mr. President, for the trust and the confidence your nomination implied.
When Mr. Ford moved to the White House a few months later, of course, he was left without a vice president, and so Gerald Ford became the second president in history to invoke the 25th Amendment. His choice, former New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller.
He comes from a family that has long been associated with the building of a better America. It's a family that has contributed significantly to many accomplishments, both at home and abroad, for the American people. It is my honor and privilege to introduce to you a good partner for me, and I think a good partner for our country and the world.
In choosing Rockefeller, Mr. Ford went to someone squarely in his own moderate wing of the Republican Party. It was a choice that caused few problems with the Democratic Congress. Rockefeller was easily confirmed. But it raised the hackles of the conservative wing of the Republican Party, which would later challenge the president for the party's nomination in 1976. For now, though, there was something else to worry about. Mr. Ford had been vice president for 8 months when the Watergate tapes were made public, and it became clear that President Nixon would not survive the scandal. Brand new President Ford was sworn in on August 9th, and on the 28th he held his first full-dress news conference. Although there were many questions on many subjects, and although the new president handled them all with fluency, what he remembered were the questions about President Nixon, about a possible pardon, about presidential papers. Too many questions.
Mr. President, aside from the special prosecutor's role, would you use your pardon authority if necessary?
Mr. President, may I just follow up on Helen's question? Are you saying, sir, that the option of a pardon for former President Nixon is still an option that you will consider depending on what the courts will do?
Of course, I make the final decision, and until it gets to me, I make no commitment one way or another.
Pursue Helen's inquiry. Have there been any communications between the special prosecutor's office and anyone on your staff regarding President Nixon?
Not to my knowledge.
Mr. President, if an indictment is brought, would you grant a pardon before any trial took place?
I said at the outset that until the matter reaches me, I am not going to make any comment during the process of whatever charges are made.
You might recognize that last voice, NPR's Nina Totenberg. She was working for a newspaper at that time. In an interview with Cokie Roberts in 2004, President Ford talked about the effect that news conference had on his thinking.
When that press conference was over, as I walked back to the Rose Room at the White House, I thought to myself, is this going to be the routine from then on? So I asked my chief counsel, Phil Buchan, to check to see whether I had the right to pardon. Well, the net result was, in the first month that I was in the White House, I spent at least 25% of my time listening to lawyers and others telling me what I should do about Mr. Nixon's problems, his papers, his tapes, etc. And I finally decided that as a new president under very difficult circumstances, I had an obligation to spend all of my time, all, on the problems of 200 million Americans. And therefore, the only way to clear the deck, to get to the substantive problems that I faced, was to pardon Mr. Nixon and get his problems off my desk in the Oval Office. And on that basis, it wasn't sentimental. It was purely practical, what I thought was in the best interest of all the people.
And so, on a Sunday morning, about a week later, President Ford announced the critical decision of his presidency. He surprised the nation and many of his supporters in Congress with the announcement that he would pardon President Richard Nixon. Gerald Ford's biographer John Robert Green said he was convinced that Mr. Ford's reasons were just what he said they were.
In his mind, Ford had to do something to disassociate his presidency from Richard Nixon. He was absolutely clear to me that this was not out of any kind of great affection for Richard Nixon, nor was it out of any conclusion that Nixon was either innocent or guilty. What he decided to do was to try to just simply end the Nixon years. And his attempt to do that was a complete failure.
Reaction to the pardon was swift and strong. Gerald DeHorst, the Washington bureau chief of the Detroit News, who Mr. Ford had tapped as his press secretary, immediately resigned. He called it a matter of conscience.
If justice is to be even-handed and administered to the rich and the poor and the weak and the powerful alike, then mercy, I thought it, when administered by a president who sets the tone for the country, also should be an act of similar kind.
Terhorst's remarkable resignation was just the beginning of the negative reaction that would last throughout the Ford presidency. In his confirmation hearings to become vice president, Mr. Ford had said that if he were to pardon Richard Nixon, the American people wouldn't stand for it. He had predicted correctly, as the CBS Evening News reported the next day, devoting most of the broadcast to the story.
According to White House statistics, phone calls are heavy now, running about 50-50. But telegrams are 6-1 against the president's decision. 600 to 700 telegrams an hour. One telegram from Virginia said, a just and courageous step, brace yourself for the liberals and the media. But from New Mexico, another telegram said, Roosevelt had his new deal, Truman had his fair deal, now Ford has his crooked deal.
The crowd outside grew to about 600 people, and as he left, Gerald Ford heard himself booed for the first time as president.
And out in Grand Forks, North Dakota yesterday, County Judge Kirk Smith heard all about the Nixon pardon, so this morning when he came to work, he promptly pardoned two prisoners who were doing time on traffic charges. Said the judge, I did it for the sake of the prisoners who were sitting up there in jail wondering why they were there.
Once again, the American people were skeptical and cynical about their president. Harvard professor Roger Porter was working in the White House at the time.
I believe the public statements that he made subsequently that Ford's reason was simply that he thought it would be in the best interest of the country to get this episode behind us. I think he felt that Nixon had been sufficiently punished by being driven from office and resigning in disgrace, and that he did not see that there would be a useful purpose served by going through a full-blown trial.
Do you think that he understood the firestorm that would ensue? Do you think he expected
it? Yeah, I don't believe he had any real idea. By having a limited number of people advising him, you almost isolate yourself from a large number of people who might be saying, well, do you realize what kind of firestorm you're going to produce? I don't think he did, but I also don't think that that would have altered his decision. He was one of those individuals who seemed relatively oblivious to political considerations in making his decisions, but I don't think that he expected the sort of huge, sharp reaction. If I recall correctly, his approval ratings plummeted 15 points virtually overnight in the wake of the pardon.
Remember, this was the aftermath of Watergate. Instantly, there was speculation that some sort of conspiracy must be afoot, some kind of deal with Nixon, that the pardon could not have happened for the reasons the president said it did. Finally, Mr. Ford agreed to return to the Capitol, taking the historic step of testifying before a House committee, in effect submitting to fairly hostile questions, like this one from New York Democrat Elizabeth Holtzman.
I would like to point out, Mr. President, that the resolutions of inquiry which have prompted your appearance here today have resulted from very dark suspicions that have been created in the public's mind. Perhaps these suspicions are totally unfounded, and I sincerely hope that they are. But nonetheless, we must all confront the reality of these suspicions. And the suspicions that were created by the circumstances of the pardon which you issued, the secrecy with which it was issued, and the reasons for which it was issued, which made people question whether or not, in fact, there was a deal.
May I comment there? I want to assure you, the members of this subcommittee, the members of the Congress, and the American people, there was no deal, period, under no circumstances.
Newspapers ran disapproving editorials. There were speeches in the House and Senate defending and attacking the presidential pardon. This was an election year. Republicans were concerned that they would pay a price at the ballot box, and they were right to worry. The pardon had the opposite effect from the one President Ford hoped for. Instead of putting Watergate behind him, he brought it again to the surface. And that year, Republicans lost everything but the safest seats in the House. President Ford ran for election 2 years later in 1976, and he lost to Jimmy Carter, the governor of Georgia. In her interview with former President Ford, Cokie Roberts asked him whether he felt the pardon was part of that defeat.
It probably had an impact because there were some people in this country who had a bitter hatred of Mr. Nixon, and anything that made him look better, they resented, and in my case, that was a vote against me in 1976.
As the 1976 presidential election demonstrated, the Ford presidency never recovered from the pardon. But there were many other things for President Ford to deal with for the next 3 years. The economy was a mess. Inflation was in double digits, but growth had stagnated. Stagflation, it was called. And then, of course, there was Vietnam. American troops had withdrawn in 1973, but the war dragged on. In April 1975, the capital of South Vietnam, Saigon, fell. It was an ignominious end to a painful war, and by most accounts it reflected badly on President Ford. But within weeks, Mr. Ford was able to turn public opinion around when an American merchant ship called the Mayaguez was captured by the now-communist Cambodian government. The president sent in the Marines.
At my direction, United States forces tonight boarded the American merchant ship SS Mayaguez and landed at the island of Koh Tang for the purpose of rescuing the crew and the ship, which had been illegally seized by Cambodian forces. They also conducted supporting strikes against nearby military operations or military installations. I have now received information that the vessel has been recovered intact and the entire crew has been rescued.
Coming up, recovering from the fall of South Vietnam, whip inflation now, First Lady Betty Ford, life after the White House, and the real legacy of Gerald R. Ford. You're listening to a special report from NPR News. This is a special report from NPR News on the life of President Gerald R. Ford. I'm Linda Wertheimer in Washington. When President Ford moved into the Oval Office, he did not move immediately to replace President Nixon's remaining staff. According to people who came to the White House with Mr. Ford, he believed that most of the staff did not deserve to lose their jobs. However, there were some top-level people who clashed right away with the new president's men. General Alexander Haig had been President Nixon's chief of staff at the end, and Mr. Ford's staff believed Haig was still protecting his old boss. Robert Hartman had run Congressman Ford's office for 10 years, and he planned to continue in that role in the White House. He was tough, irascible, and fiercely protective of his president, and age has not mellowed him.
Haig was a son of a bitch. I didn't feel strongly about any of the others. General Haig wanted to run things, and I was going to run things, and General Haig was not going to run things. General Haig was going to go back to where he belonged in the Army and run the Army if he wanted to, but he wasn't going to run the White House. And he wasn't going to tell the president what to do either. That was a difficult time.
By mid-September, Alexander Haig was out. President Ford named him commander of NATO, and Haig left Washington. Hartman maintains that he never told President Ford what to do, although he did tell him what to say. The line about our long national nightmare, possibly the most memorable thing President Ford said in office, was written by Robert Hartman. It was Hartman who coined the phrase "whip inflation now" to describe the new president's first attempt to tackle a serious national problem, double-digit inflation. The president talked about it in a speech before a joint session of Congress in October of 1974.
A very simple enlistment form will appear in many of tomorrow's newspapers along with the symbol of this new mobilization, which I'm wearing on my lapel. It bears the single word "win." I think that tells it all. I will call upon every American to join in this massive mobilization and stick with it until we do win as a nation and as a people.
Harvard economist Roger Porter was a very young member of the White House staff in 1974.
Those of us who were doing the economic stuff thought this was actually goofy. The origin, interestingly enough, was well-intentioned, which is Americans are eager to be asked to do something, and we need to provide them some substance of what we want them to do. But coming up with specific things that you want people to do often turns out to be more difficult than it appears at first glance.
Although the win buttons were initially popular, the economists were apparently correct that it takes a lot more to whip inflation than wearing a button. The idea was finally regarded as a public relations stunt. Other efforts Mr. Ford made did have a positive effect on inflation, notably his attempt to rein in congressional spending. But even for a man with an intimate knowledge of the House and many friends on Capitol Hill, keeping Congress in check was very difficult, and made more difficult, Roger Porter remembers, by the 1974 congressional elections, in which Republicans lost an astounding 43 seats.
He was remarkably successful in that inflation, which had been this huge explosion in 1974, and for the year had exceeded 13.5%, by the time Gerald Ford left office had been brought down to 4.2%.
President Ford did it by using a power only the president has. In almost continuous confrontations with the Congress, he vetoed dozens of bills, forcing the heavily Democratic Congress to make unwelcome spending cuts to change bills into legislation the president would be willing to sign. This is from an interview with Cokie Roberts in 2004.
One thing that most people don't realize, a veto by a president is not a negative action. Now, the press generally calls it a negative action, but it's an affirmative action by the president to reflect the views of all the people in the country.
President Ford began the new year, 1975, with economic problems at home, high unemployment, energy prices, and inflation, and continuing problems overseas. The American involvement in Vietnam was basically over. U.S. troops had pulled out nearly 2 years before, but Mr. Ford made one last attempt to prop up the faltering South Vietnamese government. He asked Congress to approve a multi-million-dollar infusion of money for military aid. Democratic Senator Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota reacted this way.
I don't know what they're eating over there in the White House. I mean, you know, this is ludicrous. They got about as much chance of getting $722 million of military aid as I have becoming an astronaut to Mars.
The aid request went nowhere. The South Vietnamese president resigned, and 2 days later, on April 29th, 1975, AP reporter Matt Frangiola reported the inevitable.
The Saigon government surrendered unconditionally to the Viet Cong Wednesday, ending 30 years of bloodshed.
The long war had been disastrous for three presidents before Mr. Ford, and it wasn't his war. Nevertheless, The South Vietnamese capital Saigon fell much more quickly than the U.S. had anticipated, and U.S. officials were forced to make a hasty exit in helicopters, lifting off the roof of the embassy, while South Vietnamese who'd worked with Americans pleaded to be taken along. All that was on Mr. Ford's watch, and it did not play well with the public. 2 weeks later, Cambodians, now with a communist government, seized a U.S. merchant ship, and the administration tried to rescue the image of American power along with the crew of the Mayaguez. It was a dangerous mission. More Marines died in the raid than there had been sailors on the Mayaguez, but politically, it worked.
This was an important comeback moment for Ford.
President Ford's biographer, John Robert Green, he says Mr. Ford and his holdover Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, chose to use force deliberately, and it paid off.
They discarded every possible avenue except the immediate regaining of these men on the Mayaguez. So they went in with force. Lives were lost, but Ford's polls went up, and they skyrocketed after that. It was very brief, but it was the high point of the Ford presidency.
Foreign policy successes mostly eluded President Ford for the remainder of his time in office. By the summer of 75, the president and his party were facing the 1976 presidential elections. Conservatives were moving toward California Governor Ronald Reagan. The president himself was fighting hard to hold on to his supporters. On September 5th, President Ford was in Sacramento, California, to deliver a speech to the legislature. He set out to walk the 150 yards from his hotel to the Capitol. Eyewitness Irene Morrison describes what happened next.
The president came down the walk, and everyone was shaking his hand, and all of a sudden the Secret Service men were on this girl that was standing two people away from me, and the next thing I know, they were rushing the president off, and they had in custody this girl that had supposedly had a concealed weapon in her purse.
The assailant was 26-year-old Lynette Frome, a follower of convicted mass murderer Charles Manson. Her friends called her Squeaky. The gun was loaded, but she said she never intended to fire it. 17 days later, Mr. Ford was in San Francisco and was attacked again as he walked out of the St. Francis Hotel. WCBS radio reporter George McManus captured the scene.
There's been a shot.
In this case, the assailant was a woman named Sarah Jane Moore. She missed. In both cases, the president had a matter-of-fact, calm reaction. He praised the Secret Service and went about his business. At the 1976 Republican convention, Mr. Ford was able to fight off the challenge from Ronald Reagan. But moderates staying with the president had growing concerns about his electability. One problem, despite his presidential demeanor in crises like the assassination attempts, Mr. Ford had become a laughingstock of sorts, satirized on the popular TV show Saturday Night Live by Chevy Chase, who specialized in presidential pratfalls.
My fellow Americans, I have called upon the networks tonight to make two pressing issues clear to the American public. Number one, the possible default of New York City. And number one, my stand on the Ronald Reagan announcement. The point is, do I really know what the issue is? Relevant, irrelevant, fault, default? These are just hard words. Which brings me to my first point. Let's take a look at the recent popularity polls, shall we?
Biographer John Robert Green says all that funny business was particularly unfair to President Ford.
We were not used to having a president who was that athletic. When you golf, you're going to have a few bad shots. When you ski, you're going to fall down. When it rains on metal stairs and you're coming down the stairs, you're going to fall down. Gerald Ford was not a klutz. Gerald Ford fell down a couple of times and whacked a couple of people with golf balls in the full glare of the Klieg lights and paid the political price.
President Ford certainly caused some of his most serious problems himself, notably in the last days of the campaign. After the bruising challenge from Governor Reagan at the Republican convention, he faced an unknown Democratic challenger, James Earl Carter, the former governor of Georgia. In a debate with Governor Carter, President Ford inexplicably insisted that nations behind the Iron Curtain were not dominated by the then Soviet Union.
There is no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe, and there never will be under a Ford administration.
I'm sorry, could I just follow? Did I understand you to say, sir, that the Russians are not using Eastern Europe as their own sphere of influence and occupying most of the countries there and making sure with their troops that it's a communist zone, whereas on our side of the line, the Italians and the French are still flirting with possibility?
I don't believe, Mr. Frankel, that the Yugoslavians consider themselves dominated by the Soviet Union. I don't believe that the Romanians consider themselves dominated by the Soviet Union. I don't believe that the Poles consider themselves dominated by the Soviet Union. Each of those countries is independent, autonomous. It has its own territorial integrity. And the United States does not concede that those countries are under the domination of the Soviet Union.
I would like to see Mr. Ford convince the Polish Americans and the Czech Americans and the Hungarian Americans in this country that those countries don't live under the domination and supervision of the Soviet Union behind the Iron Curtain.
The Ford staff pointed out that the president meant that Poland and Yugoslavia did not consider themselves part of the Soviet Union, but the damage was done. Carter won the debate and the election, but it was close. Ford biographer John Robert Green.
The American public really liked this man, and they had come to believe after 2.5 years that he was not up to the job.
Do you think it was the pardon that ultimately defeated President Ford in a close election where you're looking at marginal differences? Do you think that was it?
I think the pardon had a great deal to do with it, and how Jimmy Carter was able to spin the pardon into a referendum on morality. You know, two famous lines, "I'm Jimmy Carter and I will never lie to you." Of course, implying that Ford did. And then the consistent references during the campaign to the Nixon-Ford presidencies, linking them together. Had the pardon not been there, that kind of linkage wouldn't have worked. With the pardon there, both of those strategies stuck.
In 1977, President Ford began what has been a very long career as a former president. But in retirement, something happened that changed the Fords' lives. In 1978, their children confronted Mrs. Ford about her alcoholism. The Fords talked about that with NPR's Renee Montagne in 2002.
I was very upset, of course. I was very hurt. I was very cross about it because I felt here I've spent my whole married life looking after my children and my husband, and how can they say these things and how can they confront me this way? So there was a lot of crying and a lot of very upset people.
But as we look back, that action was a savior for not only Betty's life, but mine, because when she stopped drinking, a year later I did. And our action in stopping drinking extended both of our lives, and as a result, I'm 89 and Betty's 84.
Mrs. Ford's recovery inspired the creation of a new institution which has become a part of American life and language, the Betty Ford Center, outside Palm Springs, California. It's near the Ford's retirement home. It is difficult to assess the Ford presidency, which lasted only about 2.5 years. Mr. Ford came to the White House at a time when many people feared for the Republic. Terrible things had happened that had never happened before. A president had been forced to resign in disgrace. Vietnam had been a divisive disaster and then a defeat for this country. The economy was stagnant, the people depressed. Moving deliberately, as he had through his career as a legislator, President Ford slowly tried to turn things around. And things did turn around. By the summer of the bicentennial year, the July 4th of the tall ships, the national mood had brightened considerably. How much credit should go to Preston Ford? Again, biographer John Robert Green.
Ford named his autobiography A Time to Heal. And one of the great questions that has been debated by those people who have toiled in the Ford vineyards is, did he heal the country? He believed that he did. But there is a difference of opinion there as to how far Gerald Ford, with the pardon and other issues, did really heal the country.
Roger Porter served in the Ford White House at the beginning of his career. Now, all these years later, and from his vantage point at Harvard, he also talks more of healing than of policy.
Gerald Ford, in this respect, was truly the right person at the right time to place the country back on the path to peace and prosperity.
Listening to President Ford's speeches and his news conferences from back in the 50s through his time in the White House, one gets a picture of a bright, upbeat, patriotic man who believed strongly in free enterprise, muscular foreign policy, fiscal discipline, and public service. He was very much what he appeared to be, a son of the heartland, a representative of the solid values Americans admire. Even when speaking of his defeat in the only election he ever lost to Jimmy Carter in 1976.
The people have spoken. They have chosen a new president and a new Congress to work their will. I congratulate you, particularly the new members, as sincerely as I did President-elect Carter. In a few days, it will be his duty to outline for you his priorities and legislative recommendations. Tonight, I will not infringe on that responsibility, but rather wish him the very best in all that is good for our country.
President Ford spoke often of the good of the country, and always with the simple grace that came from a long life in politics, surviving many wins and many losses, and with the knowledge that at a critical moment, he had helped this country go forward. Our special report on the life of Gerald R. Ford was produced and edited by Marcus Rosenbaum with help from Raul Moreno and Diana Douglas. Special thanks to WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Linda Wertheimer, NPR News, Washington.